Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Morning. We're delighted to welcome with us a high school students who are here with our Court with Class program. We have, in alphabetical order, Darlington High School. Would those students please stand? Welcome to you. You may be seated. And we have Madison West High School. Would you please stand? Welcome to you. You didn't come as far. You may be seated. And Monticello High School. Good seeing you. I think you've got them outnumbered. You may be seated. The students have received materials about the case we are about to hear, and they will meet with a justice of the court at noon, and they will be joined by other students who are coming in at 10:45, and all of you are invited to come at noon to participate in the discussion about the procedures of the court. So let me now introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. Seated to my left is Justice John Wilcox, and he's the justice with whom you will meet at noon. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice William Babbage, and to his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and on the far right, Justice David Prosser. With these introductions concluded, we'll turn to our first case this morning, which is 022599BA in the matter of the bar admission of Edward Littlejohn, Edward Littlejohn versus the Board of Bar Examiners. Representing the petitioner today is Thomas J. Basting, Sr., and he has 25 minutes to argue. He'll be followed by Thomas J. Balistrieri, Assistant Attorney General, and then you will have Mr. Basting's 5 minutes in rebuttal. You may proceed, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. Mr. Balistrieri, my name, as the Chief Justice indicated, is Thomas J. Basting, Sr. I'm with the firm of Brennan, Style, and Basting, SC, and I represent the petitioner, Mr. Ed Littlejohn, in this case. Mr. Littlejohn is also present in court today as well. Ed Littlejohn is a Minnesota lawyer who wants to become a member of the Wisconsin Bar. He's also been admitted to practice by the Supreme Court of the Ho-Chunk Nation in Black River Falls, Wisconsin. The chronology of events leading up to his Wisconsin bar application is important, in my view, to understand exactly how we got here today, because there is, as I read the summary of this case, there is some question about just exactly what occurred at one time, and I want to go through that briefly for you. Mr. Littlejohn received a Doctor of Dental Surgery degree from the University of Minnesota in 1974, and he enrolled at the William Mitchell School of Law in 1995, after having practiced dentistry for some 21 years in Minnesota. While he was in law school, the Minnesota Board of Dentistry opened an investigation of complaints relating to his dental practice. That investigation resulted in a negotiated stipulation in August of 1997, while Mr. Littlejohn was a student at William Mitchell Law School in Minnesota, and that stipulation resulted in a suspension of his dental license. In June of 1998, less than a year later, while Mr. Littlejohn was still in law school, he petitioned the Minnesota Board of Dentistry for a reinstatement of his dental license. And his license was, in fact, reinstated by the Board of Dentistry in 1998 with conditions. In May of 99, about a year later, he graduated from law school and he took the Minnesota bar exam and he passed the Minnesota bar exam. In February of 2000, he was employed by the Ho-Chunk Nation in Black River Falls as a paralegal. The Minnesota Board of Law Examiners, and I always get those two confused because we talk about the Wisconsin Board of Bar Examiners and the Minnesota Board of Law Examiners, which is the counterpart of the Wisconsin Board of Bar Examiners in Wisconsin, weren't satisfied that Mr. Littlejohn provided evidence of his rehabilitation from the problems he had with the Board of Dentistry. Exactly the same reason that the Wisconsin Board of Bar Examiners has now refused to certify him for admission to the Wisconsin Bar. But Minnesota at that time had a 3-year waiting period. So if you applied for admission to the Minnesota bar and you were refused, you had to wait 3 years to apply again. But what the Minnesota Board of Law Examiners did for Mr. Littlejohn was to say, we're not going to make you wait for 3 years. We're going to condense that to 1 year and you can reapply for admission to the Minnesota bar within 1 year. He did, and after a second investigation, the Minnesota Board found that he had provided adequate evidence of rehabilitation and that he had showed remorse for what had occurred when his dental license was suspended, and he was then admitted to the practice of law in Minnesota without any conditions in October of 2001. After his admission to the Minnesota bar in November of 2001, he was hired by the Ho-Chunk Nation Department of Justice as a lawyer, and in December of 2001, he was admitted to practice by the Ho-Chunk Nation Supreme Court in Black River Falls, where he remains today. Having taken and passed the Wisconsin bar in July of 2001, Mr. Littlejohn then sought admission to the Wisconsin Bar, and after a hearing, the Wisconsin Board of Bar Examiners, considering what appear from the record to be exactly the same facts which were before the Minnesota Board of Law Examiners, has declined to certify Mr. Littlejohn to practice, and Mr. Littlejohn has appealed from those findings and conclusions, and that is why we are here today. It's our position that the board was wrong. What is troubling about this matter is that the Wisconsin board, from the record, does not appear to have conducted what I would call an independent investigation. On the contrary, what the Wisconsin Board appears to have done is to have had its, with one exception, has had its investigators go to Minnesota, get the records from the Minnesota Board of Dentistry, get the records from the Minnesota Board of Law Examiners, looking at those records, and then after a hearing where Mr. Littlejohn testified, using exactly the same information that was before the Minnesota Board of Law Examiners, declined to certify Mr. Littlejohn to this court.
Let me ask you just how the board should have handled it. Are you maintaining that this information is irrelevant and should not have been used, or are you saying that they, on their own, should conduct a separate investigation into, for example, the dental board's observations and findings? And if so, how would they do that?
Justice Wilcox, I'm not claiming that it was irrelevant. To the contrary, I think it's very relevant for them to obtain this information. In fact, Mr. Littlejohn supplied much of this information to the Board of Bar Examiners in Wisconsin himself. What I'm saying is that under these circumstances, the Board of Bar Examiners, having exactly the same information that a sister state agency had in considering exactly the same issue, came to a contrary conclusion without explaining why to this court. In other words, what I'm saying is that using this material and not going any further, not speaking to anybody from the Board of Law Examiners in Minnesota as to why, for example, they granted Mr. Littlejohn the license to practice in Minnesota, not speaking to anybody from the Board of Dentistry in Minnesota, trying to find out why did you reinstate his license to practice dentistry in Minnesota, which he's not doing today, but he has a license if he chose to do so. They took the materials that they had and they came to a totally different conclusion, which I suppose is a roundabout way of me getting to the point of saying there are some of the findings by the board which are clearly erroneous, including the one that they admit was clearly erroneous in their brief, and that is as to when he first began to show remorse. So I think what we need to do, having that information, and one of the reasons, one of the premises that we put forth, perhaps not as well as we should have in our brief, was that when this court, who is the ultimate decider of who can practice law in Wisconsin and under what conditions, the standard of review here is, I'm sure I don't need to remind the court of what that is that you accept the findings of the board unless they are clearly erroneous. But then taking those findings, you can come to whatever conclusion you want to in determining where that leads you as far as whether or not to admit the applicant to practice. And you can impose conditions, as the court has done in the past, on the practice of that applicant if you choose to do so.
Go finish your sentence. I didn't mean to interrupt.
And I was just going to say, and I'll get to that in a few minutes.
Let's take a look at the findings of fact. They're lettered A through H. And let me see if I understand your position. A is, and all of these are have the prefatory sentence of the applicant did not demonstrate that he satisfied the requirements for bar admission. And then these are the findings of fact as to why.
Yes.
A deals with his misrepresenting his appearance as a speaker at a national dental conference. And your response to that is what? That it was in 1984?
Well, number one, it was so remote in time. It was almost now 20 years ago, 19 years ago now. He was asked about that at the hearing. One of the members of the board had this small ad, which is part of the record. It wasn't an ad. It was a newspaper story, small little blurb in the newspaper, and asked him whether, in fact, he ever spoke at this meeting. He testified that the ad said that he was report said that he was scheduled to speak and that President Reagan was scheduled to appear. Turned out that, as he testified, when he got to the meeting, some other speaker replaced him and President Reagan, for some reason, did not appear. That, at that time, that particular issue became the subject of a complaint that was given to the Minnesota Board of Dentistry, and they dealt with it. That's part of the record here as well. And they said, we're going to give you a warning. My point was that by saying that he misrepresented his appearance, our view is that the record does not sustain misrepresentation of his appearance at that meeting, and besides that, it was so long ago that it should not have relevance to his application now for admission.
I want to just walk through these quickly so I understand your position. With regard to B and C, I understand your position is essentially that they deal with complaints that have been advanced before the Minnesota Board of Dentistry. He was suspended and they've been reinstated.
That's correct.
As I get to D, E, F, and G, which I want to be the focus of my inquiry, all of those deal with remorse. Either when did he first have remorse? But it seems to me the essence of the findings of fact in D, E, F, and G are that although he acknowledged some responsibility and that he expressed remorse, that the board didn't think the remorse was sincere. How do we, how should we as a court review this underpinning of findings D, E, F, and G, that, okay, he expressed remorse, but we don't think he's really sincere about it? How should we deal with that?
Remorse is a word that I have difficulty defining other than to say feeling sorry for something I did in the past. Is remorse an issue of credibility? I don't think so. I don't think that remorse, in other words, if we're going to go to the point where we're saying it's up to the board to determine the credibility of the witness, and if the board says we don't think that the witness is credible, this court can do little about that because it's the trier of fact, in this case the board, who makes a determination of that credibility. My point is that remorse is better expressed in writing, and as we pointed out in our brief, in his submissions both to the Minnesota Board of Law Examiners and in his submissions to the Wisconsin Board of Bar Examiners, Mr. Littlejohn expressed remorse time and again for the problems that he had that he said were self-imposed problems while he practiced dentistry. Should failure to show remorse be a reason for denying someone admission to the bar? I guess that's what this court has to decide. I think that is such a nebulous concept that it's hard to put your hands around it as to what it really means. One of the things we pointed out here, and one of these findings, is that the board said his first expression of remorse came at the hearing. They later admitted that that was not correct, that that was an error that he, in fact, had in his written submissions to the bar when he first applied, expressed remorse for the problems that he had when he was a practicing dentist. I don't know if I've been responsive to your question, Justice Bradley, but that's how we view the remorse issue. What should this court do? I think this court needs to look at other issues regarding Mr. Littlejohn besides just this question of remorse. I don't, and someone, Ms. Balistrieri, may say that I'm wrong, but I don't find that expression of remorse to be anywhere in the rules that say if a lawyer, for example, has a past conviction for something that deals with misrepresentation, not a lawyer but an applicant, to the practice of law, that somehow there has to be a finding that he's remorseful for that. I think there are other facts that we have to deal with.
I tend to agree with you on the issue of remorse, but to me the more important issue is remorse for what? And I refer specifically to the stipulation that he entered into.
Yes.
With the Minnesota Board of Dentistry, all of which I think are very reflective upon his integrity. and they're outlined on page 4 of the state's brief, but just to give you a quick, he opined that the dentist at the Mayo Clinic did not know where the implants were located. They might break her jaw and could give her a heart attack. He noted in a patient's record that 4 implants were solid and could not be moved when they were grossly loose and infected. He told a patient that a plastic bridge, which was merely temporary, was actually would last 10 to 12 years. He led a patient to believe that the temporary plastic crown he installed was permanent. There's the injection of this protamine zinc insulin. Those, it seems to me, are highly reflective, if true, of the moral character and fitness to practice law, because our profession does demand a high degree of integrity.
But
I'd like you to respond to those.
And Justice Babich, neither I nor Mr. Littlejohn during the course of the proceedings before the board took any issue regarding those matters. They are troubling, but my point is that they were dealt with by the Minnesota Board of Dentistry, the administrative agency in Minnesota where at that time Dr. Littlejohn lived and practiced dentistry successfully for a number of years until he got into this difficulty in the investigation in 97. But the Minnesota Board of Dentistry dealt with each and every one of those, and saw fit to reinstate his license to practice dentistry. So if these issues were so bad and reflected so much on the integrity of this man, should they haunt him for the rest of his life? Should he never be able to become a practicing lawyer in Wisconsin because of those issues? Our point is that since the Minnesota Board of Dentistry dealt with it and saw fit to reinstate his license, that is an issue that should have been considered by the board here, but they are silent as to that.
Was Mr. Littlejohn the subject of any lawsuits as a result of any of these practices as a dentist?
As pointed out in the record and in the materials from the Minnesota Board of Dentistry, he was a defendant in several malpractice cases, and there were findings against him, and judgments were paid, and the patients received compensation. He was insured, and all those, all of them, there were two or three.
Claims of over $500,000 paid by his liability insurer.
That's correct.
Was
that's
over $500,000 paid, was that just the claims?
Paid.
$500,000 paid.
Yes.
From 88 to 95.
Over a 7-year period, yes.
You seem to be suggesting that as a legal matter, the fact that the Minnesota Board of Dentistry reinstated his license to practice dentistry with conditions, as I understand it, in Minnesota, and because the Minnesota Bar of Law or Board of Law Examiners, after initially declining to certify his character and fitness in Minnesota, eventually admitted him, that creates some sort of a presumption here that he meets our state's character and fitness standards. And I don't know that that's the law.
It's not. Justice Sykes, I would be first to say that. I could find nothing that says that I could suggest to you that is the law. What I'm suggesting to the court is that where you have a lawyer applying for admission in Wisconsin who has been the subject of an investigation in another state for the same facts that are before the Board of Bar Examiners here, that the Board of Bar Examiners here should, as a matter of law, be required to give some deference to the findings in that state, and here in that sister state. And I'm suggesting to you that perhaps under these facts, and when I said these facts were troubling, what I meant was that the board in its findings didn't tell you that his dental license was reinstated. The board in its findings didn't, they said he was licensed to practice in Minnesota, but they didn't really go into any of the reasons. And as the record shows from what we submitted, the Board of Law Examiners in Minnesota had exactly these facts, and they talked about remorse and rehabilitation and were satisfied that he was. So where does this all lead us, and what are we asking you to do? And I wanted to get to that before I have to shut up and sit down. And that is that Mr. Littlejohn is currently practicing as a tribal attorney with the Ho-Chunk Nation. Part of his requirement for continuing to practice as a tribal attorney with the Ho-Chunk Nation is to gain admission to the Wisconsin Bar. What we are suggesting to this court is, on this record, since only this court can impose conditions, we couldn't, even though I suggested to the board at one point that they might be able to subtly recommend something to this court, they quickly advised me that was not their job, that this court could admit Mr. Littlejohn with conditions. This court could admit him to practice with the condition that he only be allowed to practice as a tribal attorney for the Ho-Chunk Nation. That would not be something that is beyond this court's discretion. And he could continue his employment with the Ho-Chunk Nation as a tribal attorney. He still lives in Minnesota. He travels to Black River Falls on a daily basis to his work as a tribal attorney there, but the Ho-Chunk Nation has said, you are required to become a member of the Wisconsin Bar. And although that was as far as the record is concerned, that was in the record in the testimony at the hearing, but the record documents are silent as to that issue. There's a contract in the record, but the conditions of employment for tribal attorneys for the Ho-Chunk, one of the conditions, for example, you have to have a driver's license and so forth, which is not as part of the contract, but they say you need to become a member of the Wisconsin Bar.
What we're suggesting,
yes, Justice Breyer.
Since you're talking about his service as an attorney with the Ho-Chunk Nation, have you and your client had the opportunity to review an affidavit that was just filed by a Leslie Parker Cohan, a co-worker of his with the Ho-Chunk Nation?
Mr. Balistrieri and I agreed before the hearing today that we would not talk about that, principally because
aren't part of the agreement.
It's not part of the record.
Right.
There was a motion brought by Mr. Rankin, who is not an attorney of record in this case. Mr. Balistrieri is the attorney of record for the board, and I'm aware that I received it by fax less than 48 hours ago. I don't want to respond with things that are not in the record.
Well, why don't you not respond to the substance and respond to whether we should take notice of it or how we should handle it? Because we have not done that. Is that all right with you for the moment, Justice Brooks?
I believe the position that I would intend to take when the court gives me the opportunity, which I guess is right now, my red light is on if I can go for a moment, would be that, number one, it was filed too late. Number two, it is filled with rank hearsay. I have not had an opportunity to file a supplemental affidavit that if I could, for example, I would be able perhaps to file an affidavit that would say Mr. Littlejohn has also now been admitted as an attorney in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. There are other things that I could supplement the record with that has happened since this hearing, but I don't choose to do that, and I think the court should not consider this affidavit as part of the record in this case. That's my position. Or if the court says we are going to consider it, then I think I should be given an opportunity to provide the court with some additional materials in response to that.
I wanted to raise the issue because, as you know, we've all received a copy of this. And so, you know, we can say, okay, we're not going to consider it. The problem is that I think everybody in the court has read it.
Yeah,
and so in that situation, I wanted to be sure that you had an opportunity, if you desired, to reply to this.
Well, I do desire to reply to it, but it's kind of like my saying to, you know, the Wizard of Oz saying, ignore that man behind the curtain. It's hard for you to ignore it. It's there. I can respond. I would like to respond to it on the record if the court gives me an opportunity.
We'll let you know.
Thank you.
Could I, Chief?
Yes, go ahead.
I am struck by the suggestion that this court would say, we admit you as members of the Wisconsin Bar, but you may only practice before or with the Ho-Chunk Nation. I mean, is there any precedent for that?
No, I don't think a Ho-Chunk tribal attorney has ever been before this court on the issue of admission to the Wisconsin Bar. And I'm not aware of any precedent anywhere in the country on that issue. What I am aware of is that this court has broad discretion to admit someone to the Wisconsin Bar under conditions. And that's a condition that I think in this case could be used by this court and would be appropriate.
What would this court be saying about tribal courts? I mean, would we be saying, for example, would we be prohibiting Dr. Littlejohn from appearing before the Menominee Tribal Court?
If the Menominee Tribal Court allowed him to appear pro hoc vice, I believe he could. I think it's exactly the same under those circumstances. He can clearly, as a member now of the Supreme Court of the Ho-Chunk Nation and a tribal attorney, he can practice in the tribal courts without being a member of the Wisconsin Bar. But his employer, the Ho-Chunk Nation, has said, we want you, as a condition of your continued employment with us, to become a member of the Wisconsin Bar. So I think this court, in this unique circumstance, can say, we've looked at this record. If you're troubled by it, you can admit him, period. That would be my first proposal to you, would be under these circumstances and in view of what occurred in Minnesota and in view of this nebulous issue of remorse, that you could just simply admit him to the Wisconsin Bar. But I'm suggesting that if the court is troubled with that, that this condition would work for him.
Thank you, Mr. Basting.
Thank you.
Mr. Balestrieri, Assistant Attorney General in the Department of Justice, representing the Board of Bar Examiners.
Thank you, Your Honor. You have all asked a number of questions, and I'm trying in my mind to determine the order in which I should answer them. First, I think I should address Justice Wilcox, the issue of the new affidavit. I agreed not to talk about the affidavit today because I do think that Mr. Basting ought to have an opportunity, a reasonable opportunity, to respond to it. However, I do think that the new affidavit is highly relevant, and since this court does not review the decision of the Board of Bar Examiners but makes its own de novo determination of fitness to practice law, I think it is important that the court should have all available relevant information, including relevant information that has come up after the board made its determination and after the refusal to certify fitness and character was made. And this affidavit is certainly relevant.
Was it submitted to you before it was submitted to the court?
I was aware that there was an affidavit. I had not actually seen it.
Did you know that it was going to be submitted?
I knew that it was going to be submitted, yes.
This is procedurally unusual, is it not? To have a party
the whole, his or you know, her the whole attorney. Procedure, the whole procedure in this type of case is unusual. I'm still trying to figure out what I'm doing here, who I'm representing, and what I'm supposed to do.
This does not inspire confidence.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, ordinarily, if a party is represented in court by an attorney, the attorney makes the submissions to the court, not the party on an ex parte.
Well, except that this isn't a party. That's the problem. It's not – this is – you know, it's a fact-finding bar. The board is – you know, technically a party. I read my brief here and it says versus Board of Bar Examiners, but the Board of Bar Examiners is not really an adverse party here. The Board of Bar Examiners is the fact-finding arm of this court. That's what it is, not a party. And the way I view this additional affidavit, and I think the appropriate way to view this, is an addendum to the record that was made before the board.
Ordinarily, let's accept that and analogize to administrative agencies. If an administrative agency proceeding is on appeal and the record is to be supplemented or needs to be supplemented, ordinarily that's done through counsel.
Now, when you say on appeal, do you mean a 227 or certiorari proceeding before the circuit court?
Yeah, well, yes, and then further up the line.
Yeah, see, because that's different. Because cert and 227 proceedings are on the record, because what you have is a determination by an administrative agency that then goes before a whole different arm of the government, a whole different branch. That's not what we're dealing with here. We're not dealing with a decision made by the Department of Regulation and Licensing that yanks a dentist's license, for example. And this is not a certiorari review. It's not a 227 review of that internal decision that's made by the dental board. This is your own board, your own fact-finding body that's compiling the record here. And it's a very different situation.
And the reason why I'm asking these questions is because we're obviously going to have to make a decision on the merits here. We're going to have to make some substantive law of, you know, the character and fitness requirement in the state of Wisconsin. But we're also going to have to make some procedural law here based upon what has occurred with this affidavit.
Yes, you are.
And what do you suggest we say about that?
What I suggest is that you say that your fact-finding body, the board, should be able to supplement the record before this court, the record that your own body has made, with any relevant additional information that comes before it. And that's because you determine the issue de novo. You're not here reviewing the board's determination of character and fitness. You've established that. I tried litigating that in the Ripple case, and without much avail. So that's what you're doing. You're doing this de novo. You're not reviewing the board's determination, and you ought to have all available information, not just the information that was before the board.
And then what about opportunity to respond?
Oh, there's no question there should be an opportunity to respond. And, I mean, that's why I agreed with Mr. Basting that I was not going to discuss that affidavit until he did have a reasonable opportunity to respond.
Should it go back to the board?
At this point, I see no reason for that.
But then, I mean, at least if it goes back to the board has the opportunity to call this person to look her in the eye, so to speak, and make some determinations about credibility. We've never done that. We don't do that.
No, and I don't think you have to in this case. I think that as I read the affidavit, what's critical about that affidavit is this is a person who previously submitted an affidavit saying that she supported Mr. Littlejohn's admission to the bar because she thought that he had the character and fitness. What is critical about this affidavit is now that this person, having had an opportunity to work with Mr. Littlejohn over the course of a year, now has changed her mind.
Well, if this were
the incident, could I just add one sentence, please?
Counsel, isn't the I didn't mean to
let him finish. Okay, let him finish the sentence. I'll
further.
Referee. Go ahead.
Isn't he going further?
Not refereeing. Go ahead.
Right. I just wanted to say that I think that the incidents that Ms. Cohan recites, whether they're truthful or not, is not the question. What is critical is the fact that she's changed her mind.
But would Ms. if I can't speak. I can't speak for Mr. Bastings and Mr. Littlejohn, but I would certainly like the opportunity to look her in the eye and cross-examine her and ask her about surrounding circumstances and things like that to get, you know, questions that go to her credibility. Shouldn't he be given that opportunity? Or isn't he given that opportunity at all?
Well, no one had that opportunity when she submitted her first affidavit. And this is my point here. What we're just talking about is one affidavit saying, I think he's a good guy, he ought to be admitted. Another affidavit saying, I changed my mind, I don't think he's a good guy.
I thought the agreement between you, although we were not part of that agreement,
yes,
as Justice Wilcox was attempting to point out,
yeah,
when I stopped this, that we're not going into the substance of this, but to give Mr. Bastings an opportunity. But it's my understanding the only person that appeared before the Board of Bar Examiners was Mr. Littlejohn.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
That otherwise it was done on a record, namely the Minnesota record, and apparently on any affidavit submitted because they are referred to in a general way in the findings of the board. Is that right?
Yes, there were a number of affidavits that were submitted to the board.
Let's get down to what's before us. You say it's de novo review, right?
That's
okay.
Correct. You said that.
All right. We said that. All right. And you're accepting that.
I have no choice.
All right, Mr. Balistrieri. We are in a de novo review. Now, why in de novo review is, just as Babbage pointed out, we should not consider the dentistry record of this individual.
Oh, I think you definitely should.
That's the main part, right? I mean, I don't see anything else in this findings of the BBE that relates to anything other than dentistry. Am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely correct.
Okay. Besides the speech in 1984.
Well, that was all part of the dentistry.
All right.
Business. He was representing himself as a speaker at a dental conference.
Okay. So it all relates to his practice of dentistry. That's sufficient for us to make a finding of fitness to practice law?
Well, I think you have to look at the whole record. First of all, in terms of what the Wisconsin Board of Bar Examiners can do, certainly the Wisconsin Board of Bar Examiners can look at the records of professional examining boards in a sister state, can look at the facts that were determined by those boards in a sister state, and can rely on those facts. The Wisconsin Board of Bar Examiners, however, is charged by law with making an independent determination of character and fitness, and it should not simply rubber stamp the determination of a board in a sister state. It should certainly consider the determination of the board in a sister state, but it shouldn't rubber stamp it. It has to make its own judgment.
Counsel, does this record reflect any consideration of the BBE of its sister state's counterpart?
Yes. The Wisconsin board did acquire the entire record of the proceedings of the Minnesota Bar, and at one of its conferences did discuss it.
But the findings, though, in the written opinion doesn't indicate any reference to that. Needed?
No, the findings do not.
Needed, do you think?
Well, it's pretty obvious that the Wisconsin Board didn't consider the findings or determinations of the Minnesota Board to be
relevant
or appropriate.
Do you think they are relevant as a matter of law? Your counterpart seems to be advancing that premise, that they're not necessarily controlling, but they are relevant as a matter.
Well, they are relevant. We're not taking the position that they aren't relevant and that they should not be considered. But That's all they are, is an opinion. It's somebody's opinion.
Well, then I may have misunderstood you. I know they acquired the information.
Right, and they discussed it.
Okay. Did they consider the findings and conclusions of their counterpart in Minnesota?
I don't know that I can point to anything in the record that specifically says that the Wisconsin Board considered the findings of the Minnesota Board and rejected them. And I can't point anything that expressly says that, but it's certainly implied.
If I may, let me jump to a different question. This. If he is not fit now, under character and fitness, to be admitted, what will change to make him fit in the future?
I think we would have to have some kind of acknowledgement of harm other than the fact that his ideas of the appropriate practice of dentistry differ from the Minnesota Dental Board's ideas of the appropriate practice of dentistry. Something other than just a philosophical difference between him and the dental establishment in Minnesota. I think we would have to have first some kind of acknowledgement that what he did was really wrong here. It just wasn't a difference of opinion.
Counsel, that was my first question or area of inquiry to your opposing counsel. That is, I think the record reflects several places language that is something like this. I express heartfelt remorse to the people that I have injured. I express great remorse at what I have done. Okay, there are sentences and letters or in the transcript that have, several sentences like
That's
this.
That's correct.
So in my mind, it comes down to the board in its findings, D through G, just thinking that remorse isn't sincere enough.
Isn't sincere at all.
Okay, isn't sincere at all. Okay. I don't know what to do with that as a reviewing court. If the paper record shows several indications of expressed remorse, as I believe this record does as I review it, but the board thinks that his remorse is not real or not enough, what do we as a reviewing court, how do we assess that de novo?
Well, I don't think you do.
What do we do with, because the underpinning as I really see this, the bulk of their findings deal with their perception that he is not remorseful or not remorseful enough.
Well, to answer the first part of your question, I think that this question of remorse, as you properly focus on it, is the critical difference between the Wisconsin Board's finding and the Minnesota Board's finding. As Mr. Basting points out, essentially we have the same record before the Minnesota Board of Law Examiners and the Wisconsin Board of Bar Examiners. The one critical difference is this business of remorse or lack thereof. And that is a finding of fact. State of mind, as this Court has often said in other contexts, I don't know that you've ever said it in the context of remorse, but you certainly have in the context of intent. You said that state of mind is a factual issue, and that is something, as a factual issue, it's determined by the trier of fact, and that finding is binding on a reviewing court. I think that is especially true here, because we not only have a paper record, we not only have these written expressions of remorse, but we had a hearing here where on several different occasions the members of the board questioned Mr. Littlejohn about his remorse. They were able to view his demeanor. They were able to assess whether he was credible or not. And because credibility and demeanor are an important part of the determination of whether Mr. Littlejohn was indeed sincere, was truthful, if you will, truthful, I think maybe the word here, in stating that he was sorry for what he had done, this is a finding of fact, and under your standard of review, you defer to those findings.
If I may, as I read your brief, it is the BBE's position that he has acknowledged responsibility for his actions, but that is not the same as being sorry for them.
Absolutely. There's a huge difference. And if I might allude to some of the unfortunate events that we've experienced in the past year or so, we have Osama bin Laden taking responsibility for the September 11th tragedy, saying, "I did it." You know, admitting that he was responsible for it, but hardly expressing remorse for it, hardly saying he was sorry, hardly saying, "I won't do it again." And that's the, you know, that's the important thing about remorse.
Well, to me, remorse is remorse. I don't know what to do with it, and I'm finding some difficulty. I want to zero in, what does, whether or not he has remorse regarding the proper crown to be put into someone's tooth, have to do with the practice of law in the state of Wisconsin?
Oh, it wasn't just remorse over dental procedures.
What I want you to focus on is what activity is involved that directly reflects on the character and fitness. Now, what I mean by this, one of your responses will be fraudulent billings. Okay?
And fraud in other ways.
What else besides fraudulent billings? Because I don't find an improper crown, even if he's a lousy putter in of old crowns, new crowns, temporary crowns, in and of itself, to relate at all to whether or not he has the character and fitness. But the fact that he was fraudulent does. So
yes.
Help me if you will.
Okay. And the way he was fraudulent is this. He had patients who had perfectly good silver mercury amalgam fillings in their teeth. I'm willing to bet that all of us over the age of 30 in this courtroom probably have silver amalgam fillings in our teeth, because that was, and I think probably still is, the standard practice.
No, what I don't have any, so.
He has gold.
I've never had a cavity.
Open up.
Never had a cavity, so that's not true.
Well, I stand corrected. And congratulations to you, Justice Wilcox. But the rest of us.
Anyway, in on this case. Go ahead.
The rest of us probably have these fillings in our mouths. There is a debate in the dental community over whether silver amalgam fillings are safe. Most dentists would say they are. Some dentists say they're not. But the point is, if you're going to say that a silver amalgam filling is unsafe and needs to be replaced, what do you do to replace it? You drill the old filling out and you put in a non-metallic plastic filling. Well, that's not what Dr. Littlejohn did. What Dr. Littlejohn did was he didn't just replace the filling. He took out the whole tooth, a perfectly good tooth, and replaced it with a dental implant, which costs big bucks. That's a ripoff. That's fraud. He told these people they needed these dental implants when they didn't need dental implants. And on top of it, not only did he put in dental implants that these patients didn't need, but he did it badly. He didn't sufficiently anchor them to the bone. They became loose. They became.
It just perplexes me why I should consider that he didn't sufficiently anchor an implant to the bone. How that touches upon character and fitness to practice law in the state?
Because he refused to admit he was wrong in doing that.
Oh, the remorse thing again.
Yes.
Well,
and remorse is important because a refusal to say, to refusal to admit that you've done something wrong definitely reflects on your character and fitness. I mean, if we make a mistake, we ought to be able to admit it. We don't just go and say, it's not my fault, it's the fault of that lousy court that decided against me. It's not that I filed a bad brief. It's not that I made a bad oral argument. It's that lousy court.
How about his failure to cooperate? How about his failure to maintain adequate records?
All of those reflect on character and fitness. Now, if I could just go back to the remorse business again. It's not, and I want to make this point absolutely clear, it's not just the lack of remorse that's a problem here. What is even more of a problem, what exacerbates the problem, is that he claimed he had remorse when, in fact, he did not. That is a fabrication that absolutely reflects on character and fitness to practice law. When you say, I have remorse, and in fact you don't. That is a complete lack of candor with the Board of Bar Examiners, and it's a complete lack of candor with the court.
Mr. Ballester, if you would, correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand Dr. Littlejohn's record before the Minnesota Dental Board, it's not just a case of a lack of professional competence. It's the case of an unscrupulous dentist. And they've readmitted him for whatever reason, but we have not a case of problems associated with a lack of professional competence, some dental mistakes, but in fact unscrupulous practices.
Well, it was
so
both.
So if someone has a record of unscrupulous practices in one profession, that reflects upon their character and fitness for admission to another profession.
Of course it does.
That's how I understand
yes.
this case. And I think we're all getting hung up on this issue of remorse and evaluating it.
Yeah, well,
am I wrong?
I think you're absolutely correct. I don't disagree with anything you say. But I think that remorse is, or lack thereof, is important for the two reasons I've stated. First of all, he has no remorse for these unscrupulous practices, which means that he's likely to repeat them in the future. And secondly, the fact that he said he had remorse when, in fact, the board found that he didn't have remorse is an additional problem of lack of candor and unscrupulousness.
What's the relevance of the other acts evidence issue? We bound by the rules of evidence?
I'm not certain.
Character? I mean, what about using character? What they do in one profession is an example of what you'll do in another profession.
Well,
body?
I don't think it's other. I mean, I don't think it's a question of other acts evidence. I think this is a question of relevant evidence regarding acts that go directly to his character and fitness to practice law. I mean, if you engage in an act of dishonesty, if you bill an insurance company for something that you've never done, which is one of the things that Dr. Littlejohn was accused of, I don't see that as an other act. I see that as an act that is extremely relevant and directly relevant to the issue of character.
Now, what do we know about the Minnesota Board of Dentistry allowing him back in, and what do we know about the Minnesota Board of Law Examiners allowing him to practice law in Minnesota?
Well, we have the record. We have the record of both of those boards before the court. I see my yellow light is on, so I'm going to try to condense this. I think what is important is the record before the Minnesota Board of Law Examiners. They originally denied certification.
Where are they?
Because of this history of unscrupulous practices, as it has been.
Then why did they let him in?
That's a good question. They said they were letting him in. They said they were letting him back in because they had an affidavit saying, I'm rehabilitated, and in the year that had gone by since he was denied admission, there were no additional incidents of misconduct. That's why they let him. That's why they let him in. What is critical, I think, and I want to repeat this, is that the Minnesota Board of Law Examiners did not have before it the evidence that the Wisconsin Board of Bar Examiners does, and that is Dr. Littlejohn's repudiation of this stipulation of misconduct.
Justice Babbage.
Counsel, on page 4, you list a litany of I've got five or six acts. And like others on this court, I share the concern, not so much as remorse, but as to how these reflect upon his integrity and upon Dr. Littlejohn's character. I'm specifically concerned about the alleged fact, or the fact that you state as that he billed for one service when a different service was performed, and also that he altered the dates upon which these performed. Now, that in and of itself, and I readily admit I did not go into the record, those two standing by themselves don't tell me enough to determine whether these are reflective on integrity and character. For instance, on the billing for a different service, did he gain something by doing this? Was this a dishonest act, or was it an honest mistake? Well, did he alter the dates in order to benefit himself, or did he alter the dates because he just kept bad records?
Well, that's all I can tell you is this. We're going on the basis of what the Minnesota Board of Dentistry found. The Minnesota Board of Dentistry found that he engaged in fraudulent conduct. So they considered this fraudulent conduct. We don't have a very clear record of exactly what went on here. I mean, I can't tell you exactly what he billed for and what he should have billed for and whether he got something for it. So all I can tell you is, on the basis of the Minnesota Dentistry Board, they thought that this was fraudulent
conduct.
Counsel,
does, just as a follow-up, I thought the stipulation between the doctor and the dentistry board, the word fraud did not appear in that stipulation. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's my understanding.
If it doesn't appear in the stipulation, it certainly appears in the Minnesota Dental Board's findings.
Let me ask. The suggestion has been made that we could condition admission to practice before the tribal court of the Ho-Chunk Nation. What is your reaction to that?
I don't think you can do that. When you admit someone into practice of law in Wisconsin, what you're doing is admitting them to practice in the courts of the state of Wisconsin. The Ho-Chunk Tribal Court is not a court of the state of Wisconsin. The Ho-Chunk Nation, of course, is a sovereign nation. They have their own court system, which is completely independent of the Wisconsin court system. And so what you would be saying is, we admit you to practice of law in Wisconsin, but you can't practice in any Wisconsin court. Instead, we're saying that you can practice in a court where we don't have any authority to tell you whether you can practice or not. It just strikes me as being just completely incongruous.
Well, it seems to me Dr. Littlejohn has passed the bar exam here, passed the bar exam in Minnesota, so that this is not ostensibly a question of competence.
Well, at least in terms of legal knowledge. And there's a difference between having legal knowledge and being able to translate that into services for your client.
But I think the suggestion that troubles me is that we might be, I guess we're being asked, or there's at least the suggestion is before us, is that on character and fitness, we don't permit him to practice in Dane County or Sauk County, but we do permit him to practice in the tribal court of the Ho-Chunk Nation. I mean, what kind of message is that sending?
A very bad one, in my judgment. I see my red light is on. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Balistrary. Ms. Bastings?
Thank you. The Minnesota Board of Law Examiners never used the word remorse. They use the word rehabilitation. And in the record, you will find the first report of the Minnesota Board of Law Examiners saying, we are not satisfied that Dr. Littlejohn has been rehabilitated to the point where we are comfortable certifying his character and fitness to practice law in the state of Minnesota. But we're going to give him a year. The report, which is in the record, from the Minnesota Board of Law Examiners approximately 1 year later, when Mr. Littlejohn reapplied, was that they were satisfied that he had been rehabilitated. They never really got into the nebulous area of remorse that we've been talking about here today.
Do we know what that was based on other than the passage of time?
Yes. The record would reflect that in that 1 year period, he submitted a number of affidavits from Gary Brownell, who was the Attorney General of the Ho-Chunk Nation Department of Justice, from Sheila Corbin, who was a trial attorney at the Ho-Chunk Nation, from John Swimmer, also an employee there, from Michael Wacker, who was an attorney licensed in Wisconsin and Minnesota, and is Deputy Solicitor General for the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, and Wade Davick, who was the pastor of Dr. Littlejohn's church, who also submitted an affidavit. All of those affidavits were also submitted in this case. So there were additional materials submitted. And the report from the Minnesota board was that he has now provided adequate evidence of rehabilitation, is the way they put it. And so I guess, you know, when we try to wrap our arms around what this word remorse means, I can't tell you anything more than what is in the record of what Dr. Littlejohn wrote to both the Minnesota board and to the BBE here when he made his expression saying, I am sorry. Mr. Balistrieri mentioned one thing that I wanted to respond to, and that was the issue of this business of the board saying that at the hearing he somehow recanted his stipulation with the Minnesota Board of Dentistry. You can read what was said for yourselves, but what happened was is that he was asked, were you in fact guilty of all of the charges brought by the Minnesota Board of Dentistry? He said, I am under oath here, and I have to tell you, basically, that was a stipulated settlement, and that there were some of the allegations by the Minnesota Board of Dentistry that I felt I could have contested, but I did not. That's basically how the testimony went at the hearing.
Mr. Bastings, I'm continue to be troubled by this laundry list that appeared in the red brief of what he stipulated to with the Minnesota Board, the bar exam. But when I asked Mr. Balistrieri to put a little flesh on the bones of number 4 and 5, he couldn't do it. And those were that he billed for one service when a different service was performed, and he altered the dates. Can you either give me some flesh for those bones, or at least tell me where we can find it?
I can tell you that in the record, you will find, and I probably have the advantage because I made an index for myself of the record, but Dr. Littlejohn responded to the BBE by filing what he termed narratives. And each of these narratives were in response to the some of the complaints that were brought by the Minnesota Board of Dentistry. And he also provided the response that he made in Minnesota to each and every one of those. So those are in the record. In fact, I turned to one where he addressed the issue of fraud, for example. And even though, as Justice Bradley pointed out, in that stipulation, I don't believe the word fraud appears. And no. I think we also have to keep in mind, Dr. Littlejohn, there were no criminal charges brought against him. He was not convicted of any crime or these were civil-type allegations and civil complaints that were settled. And his dental license was restored by the board. And those documents are in the record as well.
Did you have a record citation for me?
I can take you
of
to...
Of those narratives?
They're found, the whole series of narratives begin at page 262 of the record and then continue on all the way down to pretty much the end of the record.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bastings, and thank you, Mr. Ballastre, for your argument in the matter of Edward Littlejohn versus Board of Bar Examiners. That concludes our hearing on 02-2599-BA in the matter of the bar admission of Edward Littlejohn. The court will take a few moments of recess so these students may leave and other students may enter, and then we will proceed with our next argument.